trying to confuse people or to avoid telling the whole truth by using selective information or disclosing selective information or slicing and dicing data in certain ways to prove a point. And even worse, sometimes intentionally misleading people in some of these fear-mongering campaigns. I became very ashamed of what I was doing. I was not at all proud of what I was doing to earn a living. But the other thing I think that was even more important was because when I saw those folks in Wise County who could have been my neighbors, I remember my own upbringing, and I can remember my mom in particular saying, "Don't ever forget where you came from." I wrote something about that in the book, and this is the part that I'm going to read. And it's really kind of a tribute to my parents. I was born in Banner Elk, North Carolina on July 16, 1951, not because my parents lived there, but because they didn't have access to affordable quality care in the tiny town where they did live, on the other side of the Blue Ridge Mountains, Mountain City, Tennessee. There was no hospital in Mountain City, or the entire county for that matter. My parents, Blaine and Pearl Potter, were born and raised in Johnson County. Mountain City is the county seat. One of the most beautiful places on earth, in my opinion, but where even today it is hard to make a living. There were only two doctors in all of Johnson County when I was born. My mother didn't want either of them to have anything to do with bringing me into this world. She had heard good things about the hospital in Banner Elk, so that's where Dad drove her, over 30 miles of winding mountainous roads when she went into labor. Affordable quality health care wasn't the only thing my folks didn't have easy access to. Money was another. I've never met a smarter, harder working, and more resourceful man than my dad, but I probably earned more in 1 year at Cigna than he earned in 20, in the 20-some years that he worked in a brutally hot factory before he retired in 1980. Before his factory job, when I was born, he and Mom had a small farm. The main money crop was tobacco, and they ran a little country store called Potter's Grocery on Spear Branch Road outside of Mountain City. Dad built both the store and our first house next door to it with help from a couple of my uncles and cousins. Like most of the houses on Spear Branch Road at the time, ours did not have an indoor bathroom. We would not have one, in fact, until we moved when I was about six to what seemed to me to be a huge city, Kingsport, about 50 miles to the west. For more than a year before we moved to Kingsport, Dad commuted to the Blue Ridge Glass plant, where a relative had been able to get him a job while my mom stayed back and tended Potter's Grocery. Sometimes Dad was so tired after working a double shift that he would sleep in the back of his 1949 Willys Jeep wagon rather than risk driving exhausted all the way back home to Mountain City. I didn't see a lot of him during that time. And when Potter's Grocery became a money loser, they had to close the store and look for another way to support us. It seems that Mom and Dad had let their out-of-work customers, all of whom were neighbors and many of whom were relatives, run up tabs that they could never pay off. After that, we lived in a duplex close to the glass plant until Mom and Dad had saved enough money to make a down payment on a rundown house a few miles outside of town that Dad would spend months fixing up. Dad never knew much about his own father. One day when Dad was in the third grade, his father walked away and never came back, leaving my grandmother to raise nine children herself. They all had to get odd jobs to help put food on the table. When he was in his early 20s, my dad joined the Civilian Conservation Corps, a Great Depression-era work program that was created during the Roosevelt years. The CCC put Dad on a train and sent him across the country to help build a public work projects a few miles north of here in Doty, Washington. He mailed almost everything he made back home to his mother in East Tennessee, as he did later when the Army sent him to Europe and North Africa during World War II. While Dad was overseas, Mom got a wartime job working on an assembly line at a chemical plant in Kingsport. They were married just days after Dad got back home. I didn't arrive for another 6 years. Neither of my parents was able to finish high school, having to work instead. They wanted nothing more than for me to have an easier life than they had had. And they knew I wouldn't have a chance unless I had a good education. They sacrificed years to save enough money to send me to college. I'll never be able to repay them or thank them enough. I became the first person in my family to earn a college degree when I graduated from the University of Tennessee in 1973. I read that just so you'd know a bit more about me and where I came from, and I honestly don't think that had it not been for my upbringing, had I not been there to visit them, had I not picked up the newspaper and read about those folks, I would probably not be here right now. I probably would still be telling lies for the insurance industry, or at least misleading people. But because of that, because of that experience and that reminder of where I came from, that's really why I did what I did, more than anything else. It was just honoring my parents, that I knew that as much money as I was making, I really had really succeeded. I had a life that was far, far easier than they had ever had. My work was not honorable work, so that's why I ultimately decided to leave. But at this point, let's just have a conversation.
Does the health care bill benefit the insurance companies? And can it lead to a single-payer system?
In the short term, it will guarantee a significant new profit stream for the insurance companies. The requirement that we all had to buy insurance was the thing that the insurance industry wanted most out of this legislation. It's ironic that the Republicans campaigned against it, and they campaigned on a repeal and replace platform, and targeted that in particular. The lobbyists from the health insurance industry that will come to their offices and they'll have a kind of a come to Jesus kind of meeting, and they'll say, look, this is the way it's going to be. You can have your hearings all you want. That's fine. You can badmouth. You can complain about this legislation. You can repeal it if you want to over here in the House, but we know that it'll never pass in the Senate. And even if it does, the president would veto it. So we know it's not going to be repealed. Do what you need to do to satisfy the folks who you led to believe this should be repealed. You may owe them that, but keep in mind that we're the folks who really give you the contributions, and we will in the future if you do what we ask you to do. That's the way it works in Washington. So it's not going to be repealed. You'll see a lot of sand and fury. Now, is it a path for potential single payer? I think it can be if this legislation is indeed implemented as it is supposed to be. These companies will not be able to make the profits they've made in the past. There are enough regulations and restrictions on them that those profit margins can be squeezed, and investors will not like that. And Wall Street rules. And if the investors say that this is not the best place for us to invest our money, they'll move it somewhere else, and these for-profit companies will decide that they can do something else and make more money, just as they have changed, as I described earlier. The reason I explain that is because I wanted you to understand that the health insurance industry has been in great evolution for the past several years, and it will continue to evolve. And this reform legislation will force some changes that otherwise wouldn't happen. Initially, the big for-profits will win, but ultimately, I think that the profit margins will be reduced, and their business models are not sustainable for the long haul. You cannot keep shifting more and more of the cost to consumers and expect the consumers to be able to put up with your product. Yes, ma'am.
Matt Taibbi says, as long as the insurance companies function as a cartel, we can't do anything about them. What do you think?
Well, and I've said that the seven largest companies that comprise the companies that are traded on the New York Stock Exchange, they are hugely influential, and they will gain more membership in the years ahead. Some of the smaller players are not going to fare well in this reformed world. But like I said, I think that the day will come when investors will decide that health insurance is not the best place for them to make a buck. And those big companies who comprise the cartel will be looking at other things to make money. They already are doing that. Cigna has a very big and growing international division. It sells supplemental products in many other countries around the world, including China. It was a big, big deal when Cigna was able to get a joint venture partner in China to be able to sell health supplemental health insurance policies. One thing that Cigna found out, they realized, is that things like cancer insurance sells very well in Asia. It's just something that's cultural, and they're taking advantage of that. You know, in this country, many of these companies have always sold supplemental Medicare policies, and I think that may be where some of these companies will go. They'll look to see that they can make more money overseas, or they can become data management companies or health. Even you'll not see them call themselves insurance companies at all. Look on their websites; you will be hard pressed to find the word insurance or managed care these days. They call themselves health services companies. So they are evolving, and they will eventually get out of the business, in my view, of providing basic health insurance. One of the things the new law does, it requires the creation of an essential benefits package that'll be the minimum that any insurance company can offer in this country. And so insurance will become more of a commodity. And you can't make a lot of money on something that is a commodity. You have to have some way of distinguishing yourself in the marketplace or having some product that you can make more money on. And that's what's going to happen, in my view. I can't predict the future, but I can look back and see how these companies have changed their business models so drastically. And they're going to be doing it even at a greater clip, I think, in the years to come because of the legislation that was passed. Will we get a single payer to answer your question or to get back to it? Possibly, but there are a lot of things that will have to happen. The insurance industry has been able to make people fear single payer. They've gone about this every time there has been, yes, they call it socialism, that we would be going down to the slippery slope towards socialism, if we, to use that term, or that it would represent a government takeover of the healthcare system. They want us to be afraid of that, and they want us to believe the lie that the Canadians don't like their healthcare system. One of the things I want to try to do is talk in ways that conservatives can understand. They have been so manipulated by the special interest. I want people to understand how they are misled and what goes into making sure that people are misled. Millions and millions of dollars are spent every year on these disinformation campaigns to achieve public policy objectives. And I've said this before, this is another reason why our system is so irrational. It is a system in which the people who need care the most can't get it. And people resort to lying on their applications because they otherwise can't get it. What kind of a system in the world where does that make sense? And then you'll hear the conservatives saying that we need to have more attention paid to reduce fraud and abuse in the system. Well, we have a lot of fraud in the system because of the system.
Why is health care in the U.S. so costly?
One of the reasons, there are a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons why we have the most expensive healthcare system in this world, because it has become more dominated by profit, for-profit companies in both the insurance and the provider side. The other dynamic that has happened is that the for-profit insurers, in particular, with their practices, especially during the managed care era, the way that they were implementing managed care plans really infuriated a lot of doctors, and it infuriated a lot of patients. So there was a huge backlash against these companies, and the insurers had to change the way they did business. They had to loosen some of the restrictions. They had to create broader networks, for example, of doctors. They could no longer get by with these very limited networks, and they had to be less ham-fisted in the way they dealt with individual doctors. But the other thing that happened was that because the insurance companies had the upper hand in bargaining with doctors and hospitals, we saw a consolidation on the provider side of hospitals having to consolidate or affiliate, and a lot of them convert to for-profit status. So it's almost cancerous what we have seen happen. The hospitals and doctors' practices had to do the things that they did to be able to stay in business, to make sure that they got enough money at the negotiating table to stay in business and thrive. And some have not done that. Some have gone under if they haven't been able to merge. I don't know what will happen to the for-profit hospitals. because they do make a lot of money. There's no doubt they make a lot of money. But that is one of the reasons. And I say some of our problems are largely intractable, and I think they have become intractable because of the profit motive in our healthcare system.
How do these corporate executives sleep at night?
The way they sleep at night is to make sure that they are far removed from the people who are suffering. And if I had not gone to Wise County, I swear I'd still be there probably doing the same thing. And I sometimes talk about how my CEO lived his life, and this is typical of CEOs. You have a driver, a company-paid driver, and who picks you up at your house in the morning in a company-financed car, drives you to your office, and you take the elevator to your fancy office. You don't even have to go to the cafeteria to mingle with your own employees. It's brought to your desk if you want to eat there. And for a long time, your premium's paid for his lunch, by the way. Cigna finally decided that after they had to disclose that in the proxy that they might make them start paying for their lunch. But then at the end of the day, the driver's there to take them back home. And if they have to go out of town, the driver takes them to the hangar, the private hangar, where they get on the private jet to fly to a meeting. They never have to encounter people who need anything. And that becomes their life. It's in a cocoon. And you lose perspective when that happens. And then, of course, you want to make more money. There is never enough. You never make enough. You always want more. And you always have to satisfy Wall Street because that is your master. And it truly is a master. And then you rationalize that, my company does provide health care to 8 million or 10 million or 15 million or 30 million people. So those people are well served because we are making sure that they have health care coverage. You rationalize all the time, and you try to think that you're a good person because of what you do that may help someone. I did that. Sometimes when I was handling what we called high-profile cases in which the company had denied a treatment, coverage for a treatment or something like that, my job would be to explain to the executives the public relations consequences of sticking with a decision to deny coverage and the PR black eye the company would take if it kept on that path. And often the company would reverse a decision. And I would say, well, good for me. I helped that one person out. So that's how you get through the day, and that you drink a lot.
Do you think real change is possible?
Well, I do, and I think that there is a possibility. If we understand how they play the game, we're going to have to play the game based on their rules, because they set the rules of the game. But we need to understand their playbook. We need to become more sophisticated. One of the reasons why the single-payer folks have never been able to achieve anything beyond just talk about it, is that they've never developed a real strategy for persuading people or countering the lies from the special interest. You need to think. The other thing I found, I guess it was, I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was, when I talked to the advocates of reform, I realized that most of those folks didn't come out of corporate America, and they don't have that discipline of developing strategies and business plans and meeting certain goals and being held accountable by somebody. You don't have that framework, but you need to have that framework, in my view, to advance a cause. And that's one of the things I hope to maybe try to bring forward for progressives to understand is this is what our opponents do. We've got to figure out how to do the same kind of thing. We've got to think strategically. We've got to develop alliances with organizations that may seem to be strange bedfellows, for example. There's a lot of things we can do. It's not a lost cause. There is the big thing that we have to do is change the way that we elect people and some of the lobbying, and require a lot of transparency. The system right now is in place because the once these folks are elected, it is hard for them to resist the pressure from special interest. So you can be very much punished for telling the truth and doing the right thing in our political system. The money and the relationships that these big corporations have, they really rule. And one of the things that I don't think it's fear, I think it's reality. We essentially, in my view, have really lost our democracy. We have a plutocracy in this country, and I think we need to restore our democracy.
What can I do as a citizen?
Well, thank you, and I didn't plant that, but it's a perfect last question. get informed and stay informed and stay active and do things that you might think are inconsequential, but when a lot of people are doing it, it makes a difference. Write letters to the editor of your newspaper or blog or post on Daily Coast or do whatever you can to make sure that your voice is out there. Call your member of Congress when there's something being debated that you're interested in and that's really important. Know that the special interests will do that. They'll be gearing up the robocalls, and their offices will be flooded with fake phone calls. So you've got to be out there and doing something all the time. Communicate with your insurance regulator. You've got to know who he or she is and the role that he or she plays. It's a lot of hard work, quite frankly, to be informed and to be active, but that's exactly what you got to do. Other than that, affiliate with a group and whatever it might be. I'm speaking to a lot of chapters of Physicians for National Healthcare, National Health Plan, Health Program. And, it's been around for 20 years. I hope more doctors will join that organization, and I hope more citizens will find other places to affiliate. And then talk to your conservative neighbors or your relatives in ways that can connect with them emotionally. One of my big criticisms of progressives is that we think we're so damn smart that if we can present the facts to someone, they're going to agree with us because they're the facts. That don't get it. The reason that the special interests have been able to get their way is that they can concoct these lies and tell them in a way that scares people. It connects with them emotionally. And you've got to do that. You've got to make an emotional connection with people every bit as much, if not more, it's more important than the intellectual connection. So get engaged and stay engaged. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. You were just listening to Wendell Potter on health insurance, an insane system. This classic from the AR archives was recorded at Powell's Bookstore in Portland, Oregon. Wendell Potter was a former Cigna public relations executive. Today, he's an outspoken critic of the health insurance industry. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 39th year, was supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Kuhan Pakmander, Stephen Bezruchka, Francesca Albanese, Naomi Klein, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Wendell Potter on Health Insurance, an Insane System, and for Ralph Nader's latest book, Let's Start the Revolution, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Will Singer. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with the tabla maestro Zakir Hussain and the Diga Rhythm Band performing Sweet 16.
community radio stations in Canada broadcast in more than 65 different languages, this is where stories come alive and where we come together. But as big international media dominates the spotlight, local news and local voices struggle to be heard. Our government must help these local stations continue to do what they do best, serve the unique needs of our communities. We're asking you to go support the Community Radio Initiative at mycri.ca. Stand with us for community radio future.
This is Free Voices at CJSF 90.1 FM, talking to you about
Eagle Nation Universal Production Society. We are 10 board of directors and we are rejoicing for world history. Our show is based on true stories, musical and storytelling and role playing, silent crimes broken. Very interesting series of show.
And a lot of in-depth oral tradition. We play every Thursday from 3 to 4. Come and join us.